This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science, by Charles Whelan. Narrated by Karen McHugh.
Introduction. The scene is strikingly familiar. At a large American university, a graduate student stands at the front of a grand lecture hall, drawing graphs and equations on a chalkboard. He may speak proficient English. He may not. The material is dry and mathematical. Come exam time, students may be asked to derive a demand curve or differentiate a total cost function. This is Economics 101. Students are rarely asked, as they might be, why basic economics made the collapse of the Soviet Union inevitable. Allocating resources without a price system is overwhelmingly difficult in the long run. What economic benefits smokers provide for non-smokers? They die earlier, leaving more Social Security and pension benefits for the rest of us. Or why mandating more generous maternity leave benefits may actually be detrimental to women? Employers may discriminate against young women when hiring. Some students will stick with the discipline long enough to appreciate the big picture. The vast majority will not. Indeed, most bright, intellectually curious college students suffer through Econ 101, are happy to pass, and then wave goodbye to the subject forever. Economics is filed away with calculus and chemistry, rigorous subjects that required a lot of memorization and have little to do with anything that will come later in life. And, of course, a lot of bright students avoid the course in the first place. This is a shame on two levels. First, many intellectually curious people are missing a subject that is provocative, powerful, and highly relevant to almost every aspect of our lives. Economics offers insight into policy problems ranging from organ donation to affirmative action. The discipline is intuitive at times and delightfully counterintuitive at others. It's peppered with great thinkers. Some, such as Adam Smith and Milton Friedman, have captured mainstream attention. But others, such as Gary Becker and George Akerlof, have not gotten the recognition outside of academe that they deserve. Too many people who would gladly curl up with a book on the Civil War or a biography of Samuel Johnson have been scared away from a subject that should be accessible and fascinating. Second, many of our brightest citizens are economically illiterate. The media are full of references to the powerful Ben Bernanke, who's played a crucial role in the U.S. government response to the global financial crisis. But how many people can explain what exactly he does? Even many of our political leaders could use a dose of Econ 101. Just about every political debate includes an assertion by one or more candidate that outsourcing and globalization are stealing American jobs, leaving us poorer and more likely to be unemployed. International trade, like any kind of market-based competition, does create some losers. But the notion that it makes us collectively worse off is wrong. In fact, those kinds of statements are the economic equivalent of warning that the U.S. Navy is at risk of sailing over the edge of the world. In my lifetime, the guy who made the most colorful assertion along these lines was Ross Perot, a quirky third-party candidate in 1992, when Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush were running as the mainstream candidates. Perot argued emphatically during the presidential debates that the North American Free Trade Agreement would lead to a giant suckin' sound as jobs left the United States for Mexico. The phrase was memorable. The economics were wrong. It didn't happen. The Perot campaign was, as he might have put it, a dog that didn't hunt. But that doesn't mean that those world leaders who do get themselves elected have a solid grasp of basic economics. The French government in 2000 undertook a program to tackle chronic double-digit unemployment with a policy that was the economic equivalent of fool's gold. The socialist-led government lowered the maximum work week from 39 hours to 35 hours, The supposed logic was that if all people with jobs work fewer hours, then there will be work left over for the unemployed to do. The policy did have a certain intuitive appeal. Then again, so does using leeches to suck toxins out of the body. Sadly, neither leeches nor a shorter work week will cause anything but harm in the long run. The French policy was based on the fallacy that there are a fixed number of jobs in the economy, which must therefore be rationed. It's utter nonsense. The American economy has created millions of new internet-related jobs over the last three decades, jobs that not only didn't exist in 1980, but that no one could have even imagined, all without the government trying to divvy up work hours. In 2008, the French government, under Nicolas Sarkozy, passed legislation allowing companies and workers to negotiate away the 35-hour work week, in large part because the policy did nothing to fix the unemployment problem. No sane economist ever thought it would, which doesn't necessarily mean that politicians and the people who elect them were willing to listen to that advice. Which is not to say that America doesn't have its own economic issues to deal with. Anti-globalization protesters first took to the streets in Seattle in 1999, smashing windows and overturning cars to protest a meeting of the World Trade Organization. Were the protesters right? Will globalization and burgeoning world trade ruin the environment, exploit workers in the developing world, and put a McDonald's on every corner? Or was New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman closer to the mark when he called the protesters a Noah's Ark of flat earth advocates, protectionist trade unions, and yuppies looking for their 1960s fix? During the 2008 presidential primaries, Barack Obama criticized the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was negotiated during the presidency of fellow Democrat Bill Clinton. Were Obama's comments good economics, or just good politics, since he happened to be running against Bill Clinton's wife? After Chapter 12, you can decide. I offer only one promise in this book. There will be no graphs, no charts, and no equations. These tools have their place in economics. Indeed, mathematics can offer a simple, even elegant way of representing the world, not unlike telling someone that it's 72 degrees outside, rather than having to describe how warm or cool it feels. But at bottom, the most important ideas in economics are intuitive. They derive their power from bringing logic and rigor to bear on everyday problems. Consider a thought exercise proposed by Glenn Lowry, a theoretical economist at Boston University. Suppose that 10 job applicants are vying for a single position. 9 of the job candidates are white, and 1 is black. The hiring company has an affirmative action policy, stipulating that when minority and non-minority candidates are of equal merit, the minority candidate will be hired. Further, suppose that there are 2 top candidates. 1 is white, the other is black. True to policy, the firm hires the black candidate. Lowry, who is black, makes this subtle but simple point. Only 1 of the white candidates has suffered from affirmative action. The other 8 wouldn't have gotten the job anyway. Yet all 9 white candidates go away angry, feeling that they have been discriminated against. Lowry is not necessarily a foe of affirmative action. He merely adds nuance to a discussion that usually has none. Affirmative action can harm the very race relations that it seeks to heal. Or consider the periodic campaign to mandate that insurance companies cover the cost of 2 nights in the hospital for women who have delivered babies, rather than just 1. President Bill Clinton found this issue sufficiently important that he vowed in his 1998 State of the Union address to end drive-by deliveries. But there's a cost to such a plan that should be made explicit. An extra night in the hospital is not medically necessary in most cases, but it is expensive, which is why new parents don't pay for it themselves, and insurance companies don't want to pay for it either. If insurance companies are forced to offer this benefit, or any other new benefit mandated by law, then they'll recover their extra costs by raising premiums. And when premiums go up, some people on the margin will no longer be able to afford any health insurance at all. So the real policy question is, are we willing to pass a law that will make many women more comfortable if it means that a much smaller number of men and women will lose coverage for basic care? The trade-off underlying that seemingly narrow question has enormous resonance as America debates health care reform. The more generous a health care system is in the benefits it guarantees, the more it's going to cost. That's true regardless of whether the government is operating the system or not. In fact, the most important question related to health care reform often gets far too little attention. Given the proliferation of fabulously expensive medical technology, some of which produces great results and some of which doesn't, how do we design a system that says yes to procedures that justify their cost and no to those that don't? Is economics one big advertisement for the Republican Party? Not exactly. Even Milton Friedman, a Nobel laureate in economics and the most articulate spokesman for free markets, would concede that unfettered markets can lead to deeply flawed outcomes. Consider the American lust for the automobile. The problem is not that we like cars. The problem is that we don't have to pay the full cost of driving them. Yes, we buy the car and then pay for maintenance, insurance, and gasoline. But we don't have to pay for some of the other significant costs of our driving. The emissions we leave behind, the congestion we cause, the wear and tear on public roads, the danger we pose to drivers in smaller cars. The effect is a bit like a night on the town with Dad's credit card. We do a lot of things that we wouldn't do if we had to pay the whole bill. We drive huge cars. We avoid public transportation. We move to far-flung suburbs and then commute long distances. Individuals don't get the bill for this behavior, but society does, in the form of air pollution, global warming, and urban sprawl. The best way to deal with this growing problem is not the stuff that laissez-faire conservatives usually talk about. It's higher taxes on gasoline and cars. Only with those kinds of measures, as we shall explore in Chapter 3, will the cost of climbing behind the wheel of a car or a hulking SUV reflect the real social cost of that activity. Similarly, larger subsidies for public transportation would properly reward those commuters who spare the rest of us by not getting into their cars. Meanwhile, economists have done some of the most substantive work on social issues like discrimination. Have the world symphony orchestras historically discriminated against women? Harvard economist Claudia Golden and Princeton economist Cecilia Rouse came up with a novel way of finding out. In the 1950s, American orchestras began to use blind auditions, meaning that the aspiring orchestra member would perform behind screens. Judges did not know the identity or gender of the musician trying out. Did women do better under this blind system than they did when judges knew their gender? Yes, decidedly so. Once the auditions became anonymous, women were roughly 50% more likely to make it past the first round and several times more likely to make the final cut. Economics presents us with a powerful and not necessarily complex set of analytical tools that can be used to look back and explain why events unfolded the way they did. To look around and make sense of the world, and to look forward so that we can anticipate the effects of major policy changes. Economics is like gravity. Ignore it, and you'll be in for some rude surprises. The demise of the investment bank Lehman Brothers, which declared bankruptcy on September 15, 2008, ushered in the financial crisis, which deserves its frequent description as the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. How did it happen? How did so many consumers, who were supposed to have a rational understanding of their own well-being, end up crushed by a housing bubble? Who were the knuckleheads who loaned them all that money? Why did Wall Street create things like CDOs and credit default swaps? And why did they prove so devastating to the financial system? Chapter 2 makes the case that most of the reckless behavior that led to the financial crisis was predictable, given the incentives built into the system. Why did mortgage brokers originate so many reckless loans? Because it wasn't their money. They were paid on commission by the banks that made the loans. More mortgages meant more commissions, and bigger mortgages meant bigger commissions. So why were the banks willing to put so much of their own capital at risk, particularly given the incentives of the mortgage brokers who were bringing them customers? Because banks typically sell most of their mortgage loans, meaning that they get a lump sum of cash now from some third-party investor who gets the stream of future mortgage payments in return. You may now recognize this situation as an adult version of hot potato. It doesn't matter how bad a loan is, as long as you can pass it on to someone else before the borrower defaults. Okay, then, who would buy these loans? That's what Chapter 2 explains. I'll give you one clue now. Wall Street gets involved, and it doesn't end well. Having written all that, I must admit that there is some soul-searching going on in the economics profession. As obvious as the financial crisis seems after the fact, few economists saw it coming, with some notable exceptions. Virtually none anticipated how severe it might be. In the fall of 2005, several prominent economists wrote in a prestigious journal, "As of the end of 2004, our analysis reveals little evidence of a housing bubble." Wrong. Actually, the article was worse than wrong, because it was written explicitly to refute the signs of a bubble that had become obvious to many lay people, which is kind of like the fire department showing up at a house with smoke wafting from the roof and declaring, "No, that's not a fire," only to have flames start leaping from the attic 20 minutes later. There was a bubble. And it can be explained best by incorporating psychology into economics, namely, the tendency of individuals to believe that whatever is happening now is what's most likely to happen in the future. Economics is evolving, like every discipline. One of the most interesting and productive areas of inquiry is the field of behavioral economics, which explores how individuals make decisions, sometimes in ways that aren't as rational as economists have traditionally theorized. We humans underestimate some risks, obesity, and overestimate others, flying. We let emotion cloud our judgment. We overreact to both good news and bad news, rising home prices and then falling home prices. Most of this was obvious to Shakespeare, but it's relatively new to mainstream economics. As New York Times columnist David Brooks noted, "Economic behavior can be accurately predicted through elegant models." This view explains a lot, but not the current financial crisis, how so many people could be so stupid, incompetent, and self-destructive all at once. The crisis has delivered a blow to classical economics and taken a body of psychological work that was at the edge of public policy thought and brought it to front and center. Of course, most of the old ideas are still pretty darn important. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was a scholar of the Great Depression before leaving academe, a fact that has had implications far beyond the ivory tower. Chapter 10 will make the case that Bernanke's creative and aggressive interventions at the Federal Reserve, many of which were inspired by what went wrong in the 1930s, prevented a bad situation from getting much, much worse. This book walks through some of the most powerful concepts in economics while simplifying the building blocks or skipping them entirely. Each chapter covers subjects that could be made into an entire book. Indeed, there are minor points in every chapter that have launched and sustained entire academic careers. I've glossed over or skipped much of the technical structure that forms the backbone of the discipline, and that's exactly the point. One need not know where to place a load-bearing wall in order to appreciate the genius of Frank Lloyd Wright. This book is not economics for dummies. It's economics for smart people who never studied economics, or have only a vague recollection of doing so. Most of the great ideas in economics are intuitive when the dressings of complexity are peeled away. That is naked economics. Economics should not be accessible only to the experts. The ideas are too important and too interesting. Indeed, naked economics can even be fun. Chapter 1. The Power of Markets. Who feeds Paris? In 1989, as the Berlin Wall was toppling, Douglas Ivester, head of Coca-Cola Europe, and later CEO, made a snap decision. He sent his sales force to Berlin and told them to start passing out Coke. Free. In some cases, the Coca-Cola representatives were literally passing bottles of soda through holes in the wall. He recalls walking around Alexanderplatz in East Berlin at the time of the upheaval, trying to gauge whether there was any recognition of the Coke brand. Everywhere we went, we asked people what they were drinking and whether they liked Coca-Cola. But we didn't even have to say the name. We just shaped our hands like the bottle, and people understood. We decided we would move as much Coca-Cola as we could, as fast as we could, even before we knew how we would get paid. Coca-Cola quickly set up business in East Germany, giving free coolers to merchants who began to stock the real thing. It was a money-losing proposition in the short run. The East German currency was still worthless, scraps of paper to the rest of the world. But it was a brilliant business decision, made faster than any government body could ever hope to act. By 1995, per capita consumption of Coca-Cola in the former East Germany had risen to the level in West Germany, which was already a strong market. In a sense, it was Adam Smith's invisible hand passing Coca-Cola through the Berlin Wall. Coke representatives weren't undertaking any great humanitarian gesture as they passed beverages to the newly liberated East Germans. Nor were they making a bold statement about the future of communism. They were looking after business, expanding their global market, boosting profits, and making shareholders happy. And that is the punchline of capitalism. The market aligns incentives in such a way that individuals working for their own best interest, passing out Coca-Cola, spending years in graduate school, planting a field of soybeans, designing a radio that will work in the shower, leads to a thriving and ever-improving standard of living for most, though not all, members of society. Economists sometimes ask, "Who feeds Paris?" A rhetorical way of drawing attention to the mind-numbing array of things happening every moment of every day to make a modern economy work. Somehow, the right amount of fresh tuna makes its way from a fishing fleet in the South Pacific to a restaurant on the Rue de Rivoli. A neighborhood fruit vendor has exactly what his customers want every morning, from coffee to fresh papayas, even though those products may come from 10 or 15 different countries. In short, a complex economy involves billions of transactions every day, the vast majority of which happen without any direct government involvement. And it's not just that things get done. Our lives grow steadily better in the process. It's remarkable enough that we can now shop for a television 24 hours a day from the comfort of our own homes. It's equally amazing that in 1971, a 25-inch color television set cost an average worker 174 hours of wages. Today, a 25-inch color television set, one that's more dependable, gets more channels, and has better reception, costs the average worker about 23 hours of pay. If you think that a better, cheaper television set is not the best measure of social progress, a reasonable point, I concede, then perhaps you'll be moved by the fact that, during the 20th century, American life expectancy climbed from 47 years to 77, infant mortality plunged by 93%, and we wiped out or gained control over diseases such as polio, tuberculosis, typhoid, and whooping cough. Our market economy deserves a lot of the credit for that progress. There's an old Cold War story about a Soviet official who visits an American pharmacy. The brightly lit aisles are lined with thousands of remedies for every problem from bad breath to toe fungus. "Very impressive," he says. "But how can you make sure that every store stocks all of these items?" The anecdote is interesting because it betrays a total lack of understanding of how a market economy works. In America, there is no central authority that tells stores what items to stock, as there was in the Soviet Union. Stores sell the products that people want to buy, and, in turn, companies produce items that stores want to stock. The Soviet economy failed in large part because government bureaucracies directed everything, from the number of bars of soap produced by a factory in Irkutsk to the number of university students studying electrical engineering in Moscow. In the end, the task proved overwhelming. Of course, those of us accustomed to market economies have an equally poor understanding of communist central planning. I was once part of an Illinois delegation visiting Cuba. Because the visit was licensed by the U.S. government, each member of the delegation was allowed to bring back $100 worth of Cuban merchandise, including cigars. Having been raised in the era of discount stores, we all set out looking for the best price on Cohibas, so that we could get the most bang for our $100 allowance. After several fruitless hours, we discovered the whole point of communism. The price of cigars was the same everywhere. There's no competition between stores, because there's no profit, as we know it. Every store sells cigars, and everything else for that matter, at whatever price Fidel Castro or his brother Raul tells them to. And every shopkeeper selling cigars is paid the government wage for selling cigars, which is unrelated to how many cigars he or she sells. Gary Becker, a University of Chicago economist who won the Nobel Prize in 1992, has noted, borrowing from George Bernard Shaw, that economy is the art of making the most of life. Economics is the study of how we do that. There's a finite supply of everything worth having. Oil, coconut milk, perfect bodies, clean water, people who can fix jammed photocopy machines, etc. How do we allocate these things? Why is it that Bill Gates owns a private jet and you don't? He's rich, you might answer. But why is he rich? Why does he have a larger claim on the world's finite resources than everyone else? At the same time, how is it possible in a country as rich as the United States, a place where Alex Rodriguez can be paid $275 million to play baseball, that one in five children is poor, or that some adults are forced to rummage through garbage cans for food? Near my home in Chicago, the Three Dog Bakery sells cakes and pastries only for dogs. Wealthy professionals pay $16 for birthday cakes for their pets. Meanwhile, the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless estimates that 15,000 people are homeless on any given night in that same city. These kinds of disparities grow even more pronounced as we look beyond the borders of the United States. 3/4 of the people in Chad have no access to clean drinking water, let alone pastries for their pets. The World Bank estimates that half of the world's population survives on less than $2 a day. How does it all work? Or, in some cases, not work? Economics starts with one very important assumption. Individuals act to make themselves as well off as possible. To use the jargon of the profession, individuals seek to maximize their own utility, which is a similar concept to happiness, only broader. I derive utility from getting a typhoid immunization and paying taxes. Neither of these things makes me particularly happy, but they do keep me from dying of typhoid or going to jail. That, in the long run, makes me better off. Economists don't particularly care what gives us utility. They simply accept that each of us has his or her own preferences. I like coffee, old houses, classic films, dogs, bicycling, and many other things. Everyone else in the world has preferences, which may or may not have anything in common with mine. Indeed, this seemingly simple observation that different individuals have different preferences is sometimes lost on otherwise sophisticated policymakers. For example, rich people have different preferences than poor people do. Similarly, our individual preferences may change over the course of our life cycle as we hope, grow wealthier. The phrase luxury good actually has a technical meaning to economists. It's a good that we buy in increasing quantities as we grow richer. Things like sports cars and French wines. Less obviously, concern for the environment is a luxury good. Wealthy Americans are willing to spend more money to protect the environment as a fraction of their incomes than are less wealthy Americans. The same relationship holds true across countries. Wealthy nations devote a greater share of their resources to protecting the environment than do poor countries. The reason is simple enough. We care about the fate of the Bengal tiger because we can. We have homes and jobs and clean water and birthday cakes for our dogs. Here's a nettlesome policy question. Is it fair for those of us who live comfortably to impose our preferences on individuals in the developing world? Economists argue that it's not, though we do it all the time. When I read a story in the Sunday New York Times about South American villagers cutting down virgin rainforest and destroying rare ecosystems, I nearly knock over my Starbucks latte in surprise and disgust. But I am not they. My children are not starving or at risk of dying from malaria. If they were, and if chopping down a valuable wildlife habitat enabled me to afford to feed my family and buy a mosquito net, then I would sharpen my axe and start chopping. I wouldn't care how many butterflies or spotted weasels I killed. This is not to suggest that the environment in the developing world doesn't matter. It does. In fact, there are many examples of environmental degradation that will make poor countries even poorer in the long run. Cutting down those forests is bad for the rest of us, too, since deforestation is a major contributor to rising CO2 emissions. Economists often argue that rich countries ought to pay poor countries to protect natural resources that have global value. Obviously, if the developed world were more generous, then Brazilian villagers might not have to decide between destroying the rainforest and buying mosquito nets. For now, the point is more basic. It's simply bad economics to impose our preferences on individuals whose lives are much, much different. This will be an important point later in the book when we turn to globalization and world trade. Let me make one other important point regarding our individual preferences. Maximizing utility is not synonymous with acting selfishly. In 1999, The New York Times published the obituary of Osceola McCarty, a woman who died at the age of 91 after spending her life working as a laundress in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. She had lived alone in a small, sparsely furnished house with a black-and-white television that received only one channel. What made Ms. McCarty exceptional is that she was by no means poor. In fact, 4 years before her death, she gave away $150,000 to the University of Southern Mississippi, a school that she had never attended, to endow a scholarship for poor students. Does Osceola McCarty's behavior turn the field of economics on its head? Are Nobel Prizes being recalled to Stockholm? No. She simply derived more utility from saving her money and eventually giving it away than she would have from spending it on a big-screen TV or a fancy apartment. Okay, but that was just money. How about Wesley Autry, a 50-year-old construction worker in New York City? He was waiting for the subway in Upper Manhattan with his two young daughters in January 2007, when a stranger nearby began having convulsions and then fell on the train tracks. If this wasn't bad enough, the number one train was already visible as it approached the station. Mr. Autry jumped on the tracks and shielded the man as five train cars rolled over both of them, close enough that the train left a smudge of grease on Mr. Autry's hat. When the train came to a stop, he yelled from underneath, "We're okay down here, but I've got two daughters up there. Let them know their father's okay." This was all to help a complete stranger. We all routinely make altruistic decisions, albeit usually on a smaller scale. We may pay a few extra cents for dolphin-safe tuna, or send money to a favorite charity, or volunteer to serve in the armed forces. All of these things can give us utility. None would be considered selfish. Americans give more than $200 billion to assorted charities every year. We hold doors open for strangers. We practice remarkable acts of bravery and generosity. None of this is incompatible with the basic assumption that individuals seek to make themselves as well off as possible, however they happen to define that. Nor does this assumption imply that we always make perfect or even good decisions. We don't. But each of us does try to make the best possible decision given whatever information is available at the time. So, after only a few pages, we have an answer to a profound age-old philosophical question. Why did the chicken cross the road? Because it maximized his utility. Bear in mind that maximizing utility is no simple proposition. Life is complex and uncertain. There are an infinite number of things that we could be doing at any time. Indeed, every decision that we make involves some kind of trade-off. We may trade off utility now against utility in the future. For example, you may derive some satisfaction from whacking your boss on the head with a canoe paddle at the annual company picnic. But that momentary burst of utility would presumably be more than offset by the disutility of spending many years in a federal prison. But those are just my preferences. More seriously, many of our important decisions involve balancing the value of consumption now against consumption in the future. We may spend years in graduate school eating ramen noodles because it dramatically boosts our standard of living later in life. Or, conversely, we may use a credit card to purchase a big-screen television today, even though the interest on that credit card debt will lessen the amount that we can consume in the future. Similarly, we balance work and leisure. Grinding away 90 hours a week as an investment banker will generate a lot of income, but it will also leave less time to enjoy the goods that can be purchased with that income. My younger brother began his career as a management consultant with a salary that had at least one more digit than mine has now. On the other hand, he worked long and sometimes inflexible hours. One fall, we both excitedly signed up for an evening film class taught by Roger Ebert. My brother proceeded to miss every single class for 13 weeks. However large our paychecks, we can spend them on a staggering array of goods and services. When you bought this book, you implicitly decided not to spend that money somewhere else. Even if you shoplifted the book, you could have stuffed a Stephen King novel in your jacket instead, which is flattering in its own kind of way. Meanwhile, time is one of our most scarce resources. At the moment, you're reading instead of working, playing with the dog, applying to law school, shopping for groceries, or having sex. Life is about trade-offs, and so is economics. In short, getting out of bed in the morning and making breakfast involves more complex decisions than the average game of chess. Will that fried egg kill me in 28 years? How do we manage? The answer is that each of us implicitly weighs the costs and benefits of everything he or she does. An economist would say that we attempt to maximize utility given the resources at our disposal. My dad would say that we try to get the most bang for our buck. Bear in mind that the things that give us utility do not have to be material goods. If you're comparing two jobs, teaching junior high school math or marketing Camel cigarettes, the latter job would almost certainly pay more, while the former job would offer greater psychic benefits, which is a fancy way of saying that at the end of the day, you'd feel better about what you do. This is a perfectly legitimate benefit to be compared against the cost of a smaller paycheck. In the end, some people choose to teach math, and some people choose to market cigarettes. Similarly, the concept of cost is far richer, pardon the pun, than the dollars and cents you hand over at the cash register. The real cost of something is what you must give up in order to get it, which is almost always more than just cash. There is nothing free about concert tickets if you have to stand in line in the rain for 6 hours to get them. Taking the bus for $1.50 may not be cheaper than taking a taxi for $7 if you're running late for a meeting with a peevish client who will pull a $50,000 account if you keep her waiting. Shopping at a discount store saves money, but it usually costs time. I am a writer. I get paid based on what I produce. I could drive 90 miles to shop at an outlet in Kenosha, Wisconsin, to save $50 on a new pair of dress shoes. Or I could walk into Nordstrom on Michigan Avenue and buy the shoes while I'm out for lunch. I generally choose the latter. The total cost is $225, 15 minutes of my time, and some hectoring from my mother, who will invariably ask, "Why didn't you drive to Kenosha?" Every aspect of human behavior reacts to cost in some way. When the cost of something falls, it becomes more attractive to us. You can learn that by deriving a demand curve. Or you can learn it by shopping the day after Christmas, when people snap up things that they weren't willing to buy for a higher price several days earlier. Conversely, when the cost of something goes up, we use less of it. This is true of everything in life, even cigarettes and crack cocaine. Economists have calculated that a 10% decrease in the street price of cocaine eventually causes the number of adult cocaine users to grow by about 10%. Similarly, researchers estimated that the first proposed settlement between the tobacco industry and the states, rejected by the U.S. Senate in 1998, would have raised the price of a pack of cigarettes by 34%. In turn, that increase would have reduced the number of teenage smokers by a quarter, leading to 1.3 million fewer smoking-related premature deaths among the generation of Americans 17 or younger at the time. Of course, society has already raised the cost of smoking in ways that have nothing to do with the price of a pack of cigarettes. Standing outside an office building when it's 17 degrees outside is now part of the cost of smoking at work. This broad view of cost can explain some very important social phenomena, one of which is the plummeting birth rate in the developed world. Having a child is more expensive than it was 50 years ago. This is not because it's more expensive to feed and clothe another little urchin around the house. If anything, those kinds of costs have gone down because we've become far more productive at making basic consumer goods like food and clothing. Rather, the primary cost of raising a child today is the cost of the earnings foregone when a parent, still usually the mother, quits or cuts back on work to look after the child at home. Because women have better professional opportunities than ever before, it's grown more costly for them to leave the workforce. My neighbor was a neurologist until her second child was born, at which point she decided to stay home. It's expensive to quit being a neurologist. Meanwhile, most of the economic benefits of having a large family have disappeared in the developed world. Young children no longer help out on the farm or provide extra income for the family, though they can be taught at a young age to fetch a beer from the refrigerator. We no longer need to have many children in order to ensure that some of them live through childhood, or that we have enough dependents to provide for us in retirement. Even the most dour of economists would concede that we derive great pleasure from having children. The point is that it's now more expensive to have 11 of them than it used to be. The data speak to that point. The average American woman had 3.77 children in 1905. She now has 2.07, a 45% drop. There's a second powerful assumption underpinning all of economics. Firms, which can be anything from one guy selling hot dogs to a multinational corporation, attempt to maximize profits, the revenue earned by selling stuff minus the cost of producing it. In short, firms try to make as much money as possible. Hence, we have an answer to another of life's burning questions. Why did the entrepreneur cross the road? Because he could make more money on the other side. Firms take inputs, land, steel, knowledge, baseball stadiums, etc., and combine them in a way that adds value. That process can be as simple as selling cheap umbrellas on a busy corner in New York City when it starts to rain. Where do those guys come from? Or as complex as assembling Boeing 787 Dreamliner, a passenger jet that required 800,000 hours on Cray supercomputers just to design. A profitable firm is like a chef who brings home $30 worth of groceries and creates an $80 meal. She's used her talents to create something that's worth far more than the cost of the inputs. That's not always an easy thing to do. Firms must decide what to produce, how and where to produce it, how much to produce, and at what price to sell what they produce, all in the face of the same kinds of uncertainties that consumers deal with. How? These are massively complex decisions. One powerful feature of a market economy is that it directs resources to their most productive use. Why doesn't Brad Pitt sell automobile insurance? Because it would be an enormous waste of his unique talents. Yes, he's a charismatic guy who could probably sell more insurance policies than the average salesman. But he's also one of a handful of people in the world who can open a movie, meaning that millions of people around the world will go to see a film just because Brad Pitt is in it. That's money in the bank in the risky Hollywood movie business, so studios are willing to pay handsomely to put Brad Pitt in a starring role, about $30 million a film. Insurance agencies would also be willing to pay for the Pitt charisma, but more like $30,000. Brad Pitt will go where he is paid the most, and he'll be paid the most in Hollywood, because that's where he can add the most value. Prices are like giant neon billboards that flash important information. At the beginning of the chapter, we asked how a restaurant on the Rue de Rivoli in Paris has just the right amount of tuna on most nights. It's all about prices. When patrons start ordering more of the sashimi appetizer, the restaurateur places a larger order with his fish wholesaler. If tuna is growing more popular at other restaurants too, then the wholesale price will go up, meaning that fishermen somewhere in the Pacific will get paid more for their tuna catch than they used to. Some fishermen, recognizing that tuna now commands a premium over other kinds of fish, will start fishing for tuna instead of salmon. Meanwhile, some tuna fishermen will keep their boats in the water longer or switch to more expensive fishing methods that can now be justified by the higher price their catch will fetch. These guys don't care about upscale diners in Paris. They care about the wholesale price of fish. Money talks. Why are the pharmaceutical companies scouring the rainforests looking for plants with rare healing properties? Because the blockbuster drugs they may uncover earn staggering amounts of money. Other kinds of entrepreneurial activity take place on a smaller scale, but are equally impressive in their own way. For several summers, I coached a little league baseball team near Cabrini Green, which is one of Chicago's rougher neighborhoods. One of our team customs was to go out periodically for pizza, and one of our favorite spots was Chester's, a small shack at the corner of Division and Sedgwick that was a testimony to the resiliency and resourcefulness of entrepreneurs. It has since been demolished to make way for a new park as part of an aggressive development of Cabrini Green. Chester's made decent pizza and was always busy. Thus, it was basically an armed robbery waiting to happen. But that did not deter the management at Chester's. They merely installed the same kind of bulletproof glass that one would find at the drive-up window of a bank. The customers placed their money on a small carousel, which was then rotated through a gap in the bulletproof glass. The pizza came out the other direction on the same carousel. Profit opportunities attract firms like sharks to blood, even when bulletproof glass is required. We look for bold new ways to make money, creating the first reality TV show. Failing that, we look to get into a business that's making huge profits for someone else, thereby creating the next 20 increasingly pathetic reality TV shows. All the while, we're using prices to gauge what consumers want. Of course, not every market is easy to enter. When LeBron James signed a 3-year, $60 million contract with the Cleveland Cavaliers, I thought to myself, I need to play basketball for the Cleveland Cavaliers. I would have gladly played for $58 million, or, if pressed, for $58,000. Several things precluded me from entering that market, however. 1, I'm 5'10", 2, I'm slow, and 3, when shooting under pressure, I have a tendency to miss the backboard. Why is LeBron James paid $20 million a year? Because nobody else can play like him. His unique talents create a barrier to entry for the rest of us. LeBron James is also the beneficiary of what University of Chicago labor economist Sherwin Rosen dubbed the superstar phenomenon. Small differences in talent tend to become magnified into huge differentials in pay as a market becomes very large, such as the audience for professional basketball. One need only be slightly better than the competition in order to gain a large and profitable share of that market. In fact, LeBron's salary is chump change compared to what talk show host Rush Limbaugh is now paid. He recently signed an 8-year, $400 million contract with Clear Channel Communications, the company that syndicates his radio program around the country. Is Rush that much better than other political windbags willing to offer their opinions? He doesn't have to be. He need only be a tiny bit more interesting than the next best radio option at that time of day in order to attract a huge audience, 20 million listeners daily. Nobody tunes into their second favorite radio station, so it's winner-take-all when it comes to listeners and the advertisers willing to pay big bucks to reach them. Many markets have barriers that prevent new firms from entering, no matter how profitable making widgets may be. Sometimes there are physical or natural barriers. Truffles cost $500 a pound because they cannot be cultivated. They grow only in the wild and must be dug up by truffle-hunting pigs or dogs. Sometimes there are legal barriers to entry. Don't try to sell sildenafil citrate on a street corner, or you may end up in jail. This is not a drug that you snort or shoot up, nor is it illegal. It happens to be Viagra, and Pfizer holds the patent, which is a legal monopoly granted by the U.S. government. Economists may quibble over how long a patent should last or what kinds of innovation should be patentable, but most would agree that the entry barrier created by a patent is an important incentive for firms to make the kinds of investments that lead to new products. The political process creates entry barriers for dubious reasons, too. When the U.S. auto industry was facing intense competition from Japanese automakers in the 1980s, the American car companies had two basic options. One, They could create better, cheaper, more fuel-efficient cars that consumers might want to buy. Or two, they could invest heavily in lobbyists who would persuade Congress to enact tariffs and quotas that would keep Japanese cars out of the market. Some entry barriers are more subtle. The airline industry is far less competitive than it appears to be. You and some college friends could start a new airline relatively easily. The problem is that you wouldn't be able to land your planes anywhere. There are a limited number of gate spaces available at most airports, and they tend to be controlled by the big guys. At Chicago's O'Hare Airport, one of the world's biggest and busiest airports, American and United control some 80% of all the gates. Or consider a different kind of entry barrier that's become highly relevant in the Internet age. Network effects. The basic idea of a network effect is that the value of some goods rises with the number of other people using them. I don't think Microsoft Word is a particularly impressive software, but I own it anyway because I spend my days emailing documents to people who do like Word, or at least they use it. It would be very difficult to introduce a rival word processing package, no matter how good the features or how low the price, as long as most of the world is using Word. Meanwhile, firms are not just choosing what goods or services to produce, but also how to produce them. I'll never forget stepping off a plane in Kathmandu. The first thing I saw was a team of men squatting on their haunches as they cut the airport grass by hand with sickles. Labor is cheap in Nepal. Lawnmowers are very expensive. The opposite is true in the United States, which is why we don't see many teams of laborers using sickles. It's also why we have ATMs and self-service gas stations and those terribly annoying phone trees. If you are now frustrated to the point of violence, please press the pound key. All are cases where firms have automated jobs that used to be done by living beings. After all, one way to raise profits is by lowering the cost of production. That may mean laying off 20,000 workers or building a plant in Vietnam instead of Colorado. Firms, like consumers, face a staggering array of complex choices. Again, the guiding principle is relatively simple. What is going to make the firm the most money in the long run? All of which brings us to the point where producers meet consumers. How much are you going to pay for that doggy in the window? Introductory economics has a very simple answer: the market price. This is that whole supply and demand thing. The price will settle at the point where the number of dogs for sale exactly matches the number of dogs that consumers want to buy. If there are more potential pet owners than dogs available, then the price of dogs will go up. Some consumers will then decide to buy ferrets instead, and some pet shops will be induced by the prospect of higher profits to offer more dogs for sale. Eventually, the supply of dogs will match the demand. Remarkably, some markets actually work this way. If I choose to sell 100 shares of Microsoft on the NASDAQ, I have no choice but to accept the market price, which is simply the price at which the number of Microsoft shares for sale on the exchange exactly equals the number of shares that buyers would like to purchase. Most markets do not look quite so much like the textbooks. There's not a market price for Gap sweatshirts that changes by the minute, depending on the supply and demand of reasonably priced outerwear. Instead, the Gap, like most other firms, has some degree of market power, which means, very simply, that the Gap has some control over what it can charge. The Gap could sell sweatshirts for $9.99, eking out a razor-thin profit on each. Or it could sell far fewer sweatshirts for $29.99, but make a hefty profit on each. If you were in the mood to do calculus at the moment, or I had any interest in writing about it, then we would find the profit-maximizing price right now. I'm pretty sure I had to do it on a final exam once. The basic point is that the Gap will attempt to pick a price